It's very hard to get ready for an incident that will happen to us exactly once. In this case, the subject is death. We don't get to practice the end of life, so there's really no way to know how our final day or days will unfold. For some of us, there will be tension between continuing medical attempts at prolonging life and a desire to say, that's enough. Time to let go. Our guest this hour is an MD who chose a branch of medicine that's only been a board-certified specialty for a few years, palliative care, basically making people comfortable as the end comes, which will be soon. Sunita Puri is the author of the book That Good Night, Life and Medicine in the 11th Hour. Sunita Puri teaches medicine at the University of Southern California and is the medical director of palliative medicine at Keck Hospital and the Norris Comprehensive Cancer Center. Dr. Puri, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jeff. It's a real honor.
So let's start at medical school. When you started, was palliative care even a topic?
So yeah, you know, when I was in my medical training, there was a palliative care service where I did my training. But when I was a student, we didn't have formal training or teaching in palliative care at the time. So although the team was present, it wasn't teaching about how you talk about patients about the severity of their illness and how you help them decide what makes the most sense for them in the time that they have left. Those sorts of discussions were not formally taught.
And I was going to say that sounds like a bit of a departure from the standard training in medicine anyway, because it really is about listening to what the people want and having a more in-depth conversation other than just, well, we're going to try this to fix that.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. And I think that in general, teaching us how to communicate with patients, regardless of whether it's an end-of-life scenario or a palliative care scenario, is something that I feel very strongly about. Medical students should be taught better. Because even if you're not in a situation where someone may be facing the end of their life, you might find yourself in a situation where, for example, you've taken someone to the operating room for a very routine procedure that goes terribly wrong unexpectedly. And how do you talk about that with a patient and their family?
So I've been putting these things together perhaps in ways that they don't necessarily go. So end of life and palliative care, not necessarily the same kinds of care?
Exactly. So that is such an important distinction, and I'm glad you raised that point. Palliative care is a type of specialized medical care that we can offer to patients no matter what their age is and what stage of disease they have. So, for example, someone could need palliative care services when they have just gotten diagnosed with an advanced cancer. And what palliative care teams do is we attend to the physical, spiritual, and emotional dimensions of pain and suffering that come with anyone's journey with illness. And that we try to follow patients throughout their time with an illness, not just at the very end of life. So palliative care is absolutely distinct from hospice care and from true end-of-life care, which is tending to patients' symptoms and suffering in the final days to hours.
All right. So I'm glad you made that distinction because that's a good one to have. The first story you tell us about, a dialysis patient who'd had enough, is quite moving. And in fact, it's one of several quite moving stories in the book. In the case of this dialysis patient, this woman, would you tell us about the options that the palliative care doctor presented to her? You were still in training at the time, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I can still see her face. In the book, I call her Donna. That's not her real name, but she was a lady who had gone on dialysis and had been on it for several years until the point where it started, going through the treatment started to make her feel sick. When she started dialysis, she had, you know, really felt that she benefited from an energy standpoint. She felt less nauseated. She was able to eat. But as time went on, dialysis actually began to make her feel fatigued. It began to make her feel nauseated. It took the life out of her, was something that she had told me when I met her as a student. And she was admitted to the hospital because the fistula, which is a connection between an artery and vein that we need in order to connect somebody to a dialysis machine, her fistula had clogged. And she had made the decision not to have it fixed and to stop dialysis. And I sat in a room with her and the palliative care doctor I was learning from and the palliative care chaplain. And I was in awe of Donna's bravery and also in awe of how this physician talked her through what might happen for her next. Donna was pretty firm that she did not want to repair the fistula and she wasn't interested in any other option than allowing herself a peaceful and dignified death. And so what he talked about with her was what that would look like. And at the time, I still remember this so clearly, Jeff. I could tell her anything she wanted to know from all the ways I'd studied over the years. I could tell her anything about how the kidneys work and how they fail. But when she looked at me and asked, "What will happen to me as I die from kidney failure?" I had no answer for her.
In other words, you couldn't tell her how it would feel?
I couldn't tell her how it would feel, what it would look like, and how we might treat the discomfort that she would experience, or even what kind of discomfort she might have. I had no idea. And what I saw this physician do so well was to talk her through what that would look like. He talked about shortness of breath that she might have, the confusion and agitation she might have as the toxins that the kidneys usually remove are built up in her blood. And he talked about his commitment to not letting her suffer. And the options he really laid out for her were the medications that we could use to keep her comfortable, and he talked about hospice care.
Wow. So, but the real sense of care from this doctor, that it was beyond just the point of like, okay, here's what we're going to do to save you. It was like, here's what we're going to do to make you comfortable. Here's what we're going to do to give you the things that you want as the end approaches. This is a lot of what gets discussed in Sunita Puri's book, That Good Night, Life and Medicine in the 11th Hour. We'll come back and talk more with Dr. Puri. And if you'd like to join us by phone and email, we welcome you to join the conversation as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with That Good Night and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Sunita Puri, an MD who teaches medicine at the University of Southern California. She's also the medical director of palliative medicine at Keck Hospital and the Norris Comprehensive Cancer Center. And it is, in fact, palliative medicine we are talking about here today on the program, as represented in Dr. Puri's book, That Good Night, Life and Medicine in the 11th Hour, about making patients comfortable when it appears no cure is really possible. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, 800-838-3760 on the phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Sunita, it sounds like the palliative rotation that you had late in medical school really changed you.
Absolutely. At the time, you know, Jeff, I was actually deeply unsatisfied in medical school and had considered leaving. And I was really, when I did that rotation, I was looking desperately kind of for a reason to stay and to finish my training. And the reason I say that is because I kind of went into medicine with this very gauzy, rosy, idealized picture of what it meant to be a doctor. And when I started doing my rotations and seeing patients rather than studying books, I found that I actually was able to spend very little time with them, and the vast majority of my time was spent doing paperwork, ordering labs, ordering CT scans, and I actually timed myself once, and I write about this in the book, that, you know, I timed how much time I spent with patients versus how much time I spent in front of a computer, and I actually thought, I think, if I remember correctly, I spent three times as much time doing other tasks other than spending time with patients and examining them and getting to know them. And it just did not feel satisfying to me. And then I did the palliative care rotation, and I still had those other tasks to do, like checking labs, writing notes, but it was such a shift in focus and how I spoke to patients, the sort of conversations I had with them, really kind of reveling in and examining their humanity apart from just the diseases they suffered from. That was what brought me back into feeling like medicine was something I really wanted to do with my life and that palliative medicine was my calling.
We should back up a bit and explain to listeners and potential readers that there was a bit of a legacy in the family as well, because your mother is an anesthesiologist, right?
Yes. So my mother is an anesthesiologist, and I grew up kind of really witnessing her deep love for medicine. Her own background was, it was very unlikely that she would ever become a doctor. She grew up very poor in Mumbai, the daughter of refugees, and yet from a very young age, medicine was always her calling. And I grew up as a young girl, you know, waiting for her to leave the OR and come pick me up from school, or sitting in her call room with my brother when we had school holidays and we didn't have a babysitter. And so I very much grew up immersed in her experience of medicine and in the world of the hospital. She would put us in the surgical lounge sometimes under the really not watchful eyes of surgeons, and she would tell them, "Watch my kids, I'll be out of the OR soon." And so I grew up with scrubs everywhere. I grew up with my dad wearing T-shirts that were advertising new anesthetic agents that she was using. It was just an everyday part of my life. And even though medicine kept my mother from me because of the long hours she worked, it was still something that I deeply loved because she loved it. And, you know, as a young girl, I really just wanted to be exactly like my mother. And so I followed my mother into medicine because that's where she was.
But here you have a divergence, because, you know, the kind of work that you had known her to do, and that, of course, you learn all through your medical training, is that you take all the measures you can take to save a life. And I wonder if palliative care is a really sharp change from that, in the sense that we're talking about just keeping people comfortable instead of trying to prolong their lives.
Absolutely. And I think it is a paradigm shift, because in Western medicine, especially, you know, since the 1950s, when very big, dramatic changes in our ability to save lives evolved, it was, our focus is really on prolonging life. A longer life is considered a win in medicine. My mom's specialty, anesthesiology, is very much concerned with keeping patients alive in emergencies and during surgeries. And palliative care is very much about the limits of science and understanding when nature and mortality become stronger than science. And what I love about the field is that it can exist side by side with every effort to prolong life. Just as, you know, if somebody has a new diagnosis of cancer and they're getting chemotherapy, they can still get palliative care right alongside that intervention to prolong their life. But what palliative care does is we focus on the points of transition. When somebody's pain is getting worse, we come in and treat that. And when somebody might decide for themselves that maybe more chemo is going to worsen the days I have, we come in, hopefully having been by their side throughout their journey, and we can have a discussion with them about what other options they have and really reframe it as stopping chemo is not giving up, which I think is very much a dangerous part of the rhetoric in this country around how we talk about disease. And we instead say, here are other paths. All of these paths are completely legitimate. And just because we may reach a point medically where we can't cure you, that doesn't mean that we can't care for you and focus on treating the ways that the disease affects your quality of life on a day-to-day basis. So I really see the beauty of palliative care is that it coexists right alongside every other field of medicine and right alongside that technological imperative to prolong life. But it also very much makes the focus the quality of life and the number of good days we give our patients, and seeking to make that number much bigger than the number of bad days.
Sunita Puri, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an MD and author. Her book is That Good Night, Life and Medicine in the 11th Hour. Let's take a call from Dana, calling, looks like from L.A., but lives in Talent. Welcome to the Exchange.
Yes, hi. Yes, it's Danae.
Oh, Danae.
Yes, I am interested in finding out if the doctor has any experience with something called an end-of-life doula.
Okay, and it's similar to the birth doulas, but we were talking about assisting somebody out of the world instead of in.
Exactly.
All right, thanks for the call, Danae.
If you have any information, that would be fantastic. Thank you so much.
Sure. What do you know about that, Sunita?
So I know end-of-life doulas. I've also known them as death doulas, that they are growing in number, and I think that they serve an incredibly important purpose. I have not personally worked directly with a doula, but I know, I think two, maybe three of my patients have, and their families and the patients found them incredibly helpful at that transition point. And I think what death doulas represent is that we need much more than medicine to help end of life be as smooth and peaceful and dignified as possible, because really death is beyond the scope of just medicine. It's a human fact. Mortality is part of what defines being human. And I think drawing on doulas, chaplains, psychologists, social workers, people outside of medicine who very much share a focus through a different lens, though, on making the end of life peaceful and dignified, I think they're hugely important. And I hope I get the opportunity to learn more directly about what they do.
And coming back to what we said at the very outset of the segment, I mean, we only die once, and so we don't know what's coming, but people who've seen the process before will have certainly some clues to what they've seen in previous cases.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Sunita Puri, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is That Good Night, Life and Medicine in the 11th Hour. You're welcome to join the conversation on the Exchange, as Danae did. Thank you, Danae. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So how does palliative care come into the discussion, Sunita? I mean, do the patients say, you know, I'd rather have this than that, and then the attending says, okay, then you want the palliative care team, or is it broached first sometimes by the medical people?
That's a great question. So it really depends on what is going on in a specific scenario. The first thing to know is that palliative care teams, the vast majority of us work in a hospital, which means that we see patients who have been admitted to the hospital and who are sick for some reason or another. The other place that we see patients in growing numbers is in clinic. So just like people go to their primary care doctor's clinic, in a growing number of patients can now access palliative care clinics. But the vast majority of teams exist in hospitals. So if someone's in a hospital, and I'll give you a fairly typical scenario. Let's say somebody is on a cancer ward and has a lot of pain. The oncologist who's primarily managing the patient, rounding on them every day, seeing them every morning, that person would be the one to call the palliative care team, at least at our institution. At other institutions, sometimes nurses can help place consults. At USC, the doctor has to call, and it's usually with a specific request to the team. So in that scenario, they would be asking for help with the management of cancer pain, which is something that palliative care teams do very expertly. In another scenario that happens fairly common where I work, somebody might be in the intensive care unit because multiple of their organs are no longer working and they require the support of a breathing machine and dialysis, just as an example. And the scenario could be that despite giving them every possible technologic tool, they are still getting sicker. And so the team, the ICU team, might call palliative care to say, hey, you know, this patient's been on the ventilator and dialysis for 5 days. We see them getting sicker. Can you come help us talk to the family about where they are medically and where we might go from here? Those sorts of consults are called goals of care conversations. And symptom management, for things like pain and nausea, and goals of care conversations are the big requests from doctors taking care of patients. Those are the big reasons why we usually get called. In a clinic setting, if somebody is going every few weeks to get chemo and let's say their pain is a bit worse, in that setting, too, the oncologist can make a request for us to see the patient to help with their management of pain. And it usually that's kind of how it works, both in the hospital and the clinic, that the doc or the nurse, more rarely the social worker, can request consults.
You describe in the book the first session that you led with a patient. This is the gentleman who was determined to see his daughter graduate from UC Davis in 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
What were you feeling as you had to be the person to lead this discussion for the first time?
So he was a very, very dear patient of mine. Mr. Tan is the pseudonym I gave him. And I was an intern at the time. I was just 6 months out of medical school, and he had survived a very aggressive cancer of the head and neck, but was suffering innumerable consequences of the radiation and chemo that he'd gotten, and had been coming in and out of the hospital multiple times with infections in particular, and other complications. And everyone on our team knew that he was extremely sick and might not survive this hospital stay, or might not survive for the foreseeable future, even if he lasted through the hospital stay. And yet, even though we all knew that and would talk about it amongst ourselves, no one was telling him. And I felt like that task needed to come from me. And I write about in the book just how much of a struggle it was to get the words out and to be able to say to somebody, I am worried that given everything you're going through, that you may get sicker really fast and really soon. And what might you want for yourself medically if that happened? And it was just, I was stumbling for words. I didn't want to take away his hope, and I didn't know how to balance telling him realistically what was going on for him without taking away his hope. The other complicating piece of this was that his family was not English-speaking, or at least his wife was not, and so there was an interpreter there to interpret everything I was saying. And believe me, Jeff, I was not doing a good job. I was fumbling left and right, and I really felt like I was making the situation worse. And I felt this deep shame that I knew so much medically, but I didn't have the words to explain it. And I didn't have the words to comfort him as I was telling him something really difficult. And my lack of experience and training, I think, created more complications in the conversation, which was not my intention.
Ultimately, Mr. Tan did make it to that graduation 2 years later, didn't he?
He did. And that being able to attend that graduation because his family invited me, that was probably one of the most meaningful moments in the years I've been seeing patients and practicing medicine. I kind of served as their unofficial photographer, so I was taking pictures the whole time. And Mr. Tan had a stroke, and so his smile was crooked. But as big a smile as he could have smiled, that's what was on his face that day. And it was a deeply, deeply moving experience. And I actually, the college had taken some portraits of the families, but what touched me incredibly was that one of the photos I took was the one they chose to put in their living room. And just to be able to see a family through that journey, and to be a part of an occasion that was part of his big goal, his motivation for continuing to live despite his tremendous discomfort, it's moving beyond words.
Truly. Let's take a call here from Vince in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Sunita Puri, the author of That Good Night. Hi, Vince.
Hi there. Yes, I have a question. My mother, about 15 years ago, was dying from breast cancer that had spread to lungs and then eventually her brain. And she was in a lot of pain, and we requested palliative care with the help of the social worker there at the hospital. and it was accepted. And then the next time I went to visit her a day or two later, she wasn't in her room, and I asked where she was, and the nurse told me, oh, she was sent down to physical therapy, and I questioned that, and I said, why would somebody in so much pain near the end of her life need physical therapy? And they said that was part of the program. And I was just always wondering, you know, why would physical therapy be part of end-of-life palliative care?
Well, let's find out. Vince, thanks for that. Anything that you've run across, Junita?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And it sounds like maybe the communication around that piece of the plan hadn't been crystal clear. I will say that maybe about 20% of my patients that are on palliative care or hospice do get physical therapy, because part of their goal, within reason, is to stay as functional and as independent as possible. And if that's a really big goal for them and their symptoms, like their pain, is well managed to help them meet that goal, then I think physical therapy can be a hugely important part of keeping them to feel well and enjoy the days that they have. It's not always appropriate for everybody, but I do think it helps people to stay strong and independent and to feel like they're still living. So I would say in about 20% of the cases I see, patients really do benefit from physical therapy.
All right, back to talk more about That Good Night with Sunita Puri in a minute five here on the Jefferson Exchange. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about palliative care today with somebody who practices it, a medical doctor, Sunita Puri, who teaches at the University of Southern California and is the medical director of palliative medicine at the Keck Hospital and the Norris Comprehensive Cancer Center. We're talking about making patients comfortable when a cure is not really possible. It's not quite the same as hospice. We've made that distinction already, but it really is about making sure that people get care in terms of making them feel as good as they can possibly feel, even if they're not going to get better, perhaps. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The middle section of the book is called The Unlearning. Does this mean you had to unlearn a lot of stuff you'd already picked up in medical school, Sunita?
Absolutely, especially around communication. I think in medical training, as I'd mentioned earlier, I did not get a whole lot of formal education about how you talk to patients about highly sensitive subjects, be it a medical error or, you know, telling somebody that they have a diagnosis that we may not be able to cure. And so I mainly learned communication by the examples I saw. And many of the examples I saw were not necessarily clear and direct. So, for example, kind of like I had mentioned earlier, when I made that attempt to talk with Mr. Tan, I really struggled with telling him realistically what was happening without destroying his hope. I think a lot of my colleagues in medicine really deeply struggle with that balance. And so we err on the side of perpetuating hope that can veer into false hope. And we do that, I've observed, and again, with the best intentions, but we still do it. We do it by talking and talking and talking in discussions, talking about, for example, every possible treatment we could use, and then talking about all the reasons we may not be able to use them for a particular patient we're talking to. And I had to unlearn that. I had to learn instead to make the patient's voice and the family's voice the center of the discussion, and to listen far more than I was as a resident. Talking sometimes helps us as doctors to feel like we're doing something. And that drive to do something and to fix something and to reassure patients that we're doing everything we can for them, that is part of how we're socialized. And so I had to step back and observe in the early days of my palliative care training how palliative care doctors sit with patients in high-stakes circumstances and listen instead of talk in the beginning. And when they did talk, they would talk clearly, sparingly, without a lot of fluff or rambling. And it was the most compassionate communication because it was just direct. And again, I should say I have a lot of sympathy and compassion for all of us in medicine because we're not taught how to do that except when we make mistakes and we have to learn how to speak to patients a different way. But the first, 6 months of my palliative care training was really about observing how communication was done poorly and how it could be done differently. And that involved a tremendous amount of unlearning of bad habits that I developed as a resident.
But the communication is not just with the patient because you got all these other things to think about. You got medical issues. You got things like the age of the patient, the general disbelief of loved ones that no cure is possible. I mean, you got a lot of stuff to work in there, which raises the question, is there any psychology training that comes with palliative care?
That's a great question, too. And, we didn't really get formal psychology training, no. And I think, you're absolutely right that the psychology we're dealing with is not just that of the patient and their family. It's also of other doctors, of nurses, of other people involved in the care of the patient and understanding everyone's perspective. Because truly, even though our primary task is to treat the patient and support their family and loved ones, I really do believe that we as palliative care doctors also treat our colleagues and the teams around us who are struggling to accept what fate might come for a patient that they're working very hard to save.
So you had me in tears with the story of the younger woman with lymphoma you call Alice.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she could not breathe without a tube, was failing with it. I mean, you're a doctor, but you're human. I mean, how do you approach these conversations? How do you prepare yourself, I guess, is the first question.
Yep. I still see her face, and the name I gave her in the book is Alice. That was an extremely difficult case because, as you mentioned, she had a diagnosis of lymphoma that was getting worse and actually was beyond the point of treatment because she was sick with infections. And she was on a breathing machine, so she had a tube in her throat, but she was fully awake and able to interact with us, able to write down her thoughts. And I had been tasked in the first month of my palliative care training with speaking to her about what she wanted for herself in this situation. And I don't know that I prepare myself the same way every time, but in this situation, she was just a few years older than me. So she was, in her 30s and was engaged, lived actually not very far from where I had lived in San Francisco during my training. So we inhabited a similar world. And I had to prepare myself to go speak with her. I had to really do some self-talk and tell myself, this is going to be very hard. But your job in that room is to focus entirely on her and have a way to take care of yourself later. But in that room, it's almost, and when I go into patients' rooms now, it's almost like a sort of meditation that I am putting all of my focus and attention on what they're saying, and I literally can't think about anything else. And then I leave the room, and I'm able to kind of return a bit more to my own life. But I really did have to prepare myself in the situation with Alice that the outcome here is not going to be good. You are going to lose her, but you also have this incredible privilege of helping her to have a say in how this goes down and giving her at least a little bit of agency when she had no agency in getting as sick as she did. And so I try to find that silver lining too, that even though these circumstances are very, very tragic, what is the good I can do here? And sometimes the good is just sitting with someone and letting them cry, which I had to do with her too.
You point out that and we talked about your mother already, she's an anesthesiologist, so an MD as well, that your parents believe in science and God, but you struggled with helping patients and talking about God or providing some sort of spiritual outlet for them at a time when some of them need it. I mean, can you tell us about the doctor who helped you with that?
Yes. So in the book, I've given her the name Christina Wynn. And she is an extraordinary woman and an extraordinary doctor who herself was deeply spiritual, just like my mother, but also was a physician and believed very much in science and believed that spirituality and science can sit side by side and coexist. And she and I took care of a young man I called Jack, who had suffered a terrible consequence of a medical procedure and was in a vegetative state. And Jack also was in his 30s. So his parents and Dr. Nguyen and I were all having discussions about how sick he was. He'd developed an infection that was resistant to a number of antibiotics, and it was really only a matter of time before we ran out of antibiotics that would help him. And I saw Dr. Nguyen sit with them, and they were deeply religious Catholics and believed very much that a miracle was going to take place and that one day Jack would wake up and be their son again, and that we needed to provide everything we could to help that miracle happen. And Dr. Nguyen was talking about how we can hope for the miracle, but that we also have to draw some limits in what we provide so that Jack doesn't suffer if, for example, his heart stops. And she used a phrase that I still use to this day when it's appropriate. And she said to them that, you know, when the heart stops, some people might consider that God's call. And so she was talking about CPR in a way, in language that deeply resonated with them. I, as usual, had screwed up the conversation and was talking, I don't even remember exactly what I was saying, but I was basically trying to help them understand that putting him through resuscitative efforts may only cause more suffering, given how sick he was overall. But she was able to say the same thing to them in a way that they understood, and in a way that didn't take away their hope for a miracle, and in a way that validated their faith. And it was one of the most incredible moments in my training to see this woman, who to this day I kind of idolize, to see her do that, to see her be the best kind of doctor to these parents by also drawing on their faith, which was their lifeline through this whole ordeal. And we were able to help them understand that putting him through CPR at the very end of his life would not help him. But we could only do it by meeting them exactly where they were.
Ah, that's the key, where they were, yeah, finding them there. Sunita, do you feel like you use more of your whole person as a human being in this branch of medicine than in the other branches you did rotations in?
I do. You know, I think I also, as I wrote about in the book, I really loved working in the intensive care unit, in part because my mother, as an anesthesiologist, had done a lot of work in ICU settings, and I was able to do many of the same procedures and things that she did on a daily basis. So I felt a kinship with her when I was doing rotations in the ICU. I still deeply love the ICU and the ways we can help people in that setting. But I didn't feel like every part of myself was something I could draw upon in that setting. And I think in palliative medicine, there's a home for me as a doctor, but there's also a home for me as a person. And I can bring my exposure to spirituality as a young person from my parents into my practice with patients, again, if it's appropriate and if we're talking about spiritual aspects of their care. I think I can kind of be myself in a way that I couldn't necessarily in other settings. And I do think that's a part of how any physician chooses what to specialize in, is where do they feel most at home on a gut level. And that's the reason why we have physicians in very different specialties, because each of us is a unique person, and we find our home, for example, in cardiology rather than palliative care, or someone might think their home is in surgery because of who they are and the traits that make them who they are. So I just feel like all of my selves really exist together and harmoniously in palliative medicine.
How heated did the discussions get with your parents, though, when you said this was the field you wanted to go into?
Oh, they thought I was crazy. My mom is a physician, and she thought, why would you do all of this work only to take care of patients that you can't save? And it was a bit of a shocker because so much of the reason that I loved palliative medicine was because my parents had given me a different outlook on life's end. They had really normalized that mortality and impermanence and change are just part of the human condition, and that we suffer when we cannot accept that. And so to have them say to me, why would you want to take care of patients who you can't save? It was a real shock. And I think that my mom, in a very motherly way, was worried that I, as a, you know, fairly sensitive soul, would not be able to handle what I saw. So I think she was being protective. But there was also, again, that evidence of just how deeply she was socialized to believe that medicine is primarily a life-saving enterprise, when actually, you know, we all took an oath to do no harm and instead to walk by our patients no matter what stage of life or the dying process they were in. And I think one of the most moving things, one of the most moving exchanges I've ever had with my mom, which I write about in the book, was when she finally said to me, I could never do what you do, and I respect it so much. And that was the validation I think I had been looking for a long time.
Wow. So your mom was actually expressing some admiration for you, where you had had the admiration for her all those years.
Exactly.
A long family history in medicine, or at least a couple generations here. And Sunita Puri reflects upon those and about what she learned in palliative care in the book That Good Night, Life and Medicine in the 11th Hour. Dr. Puri, thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much, Jeff. It's been great.
Take care. It's been a pleasure.